I want to welcome James Wilder to Upcoming Disc, and I want to thank you for taking your time to spend some time with us and talking about Three Holes in a Gun, which the reason why I hang on the end there is because some of the press that I'm reading says the movie's called, and I think on the titles in the movie, it said Three Holes, Two Brads in a Gun.
I think it's actually Three Holes in a Smoking Gun.
A Smoking Gun.
Originally, it was Three Holes, Two Brads in a Smoking Gun.
Right, and at least the copy that I have, I think the Two Brads is still in there. Can you tell me a little bit about that change?
Well, yeah, I'll tell you about the change. Originally, it was a writer. The story is about a writer.
Yes.
What I play in the movie. And so the Three Holes, Two Brads, and Brads are those brass tacks that you put together in a Hollywood script.
Right.
And a smoking gun. And the play on the word with the smoking gun is that it's a dubious situation on the ownership of a script.
Sure.
And I think what they did was a lot of people don't get the Two Brads because how many people are delivered scripts?
Right.
So the Three Holes and a Smoking Gun gives it a bit more of that Guy Ritchie title. And, you know, someone would associate Three Holes and a Smoking Gun to, like, somebody shot two people or shot three holes, but then it's a play on words.
Right.
So that the story's not about that at all.
Exactly.
It's not at all a, you know, action kill picture. It's like a cool Hollywood, you know, possession of script, kind of a little bit of, like, you know, The Player.
And there's a lot of film noir atmosphere in this film. Yeah, I was going to say, there's a lot of film noir atmosphere in this film.
Yeah, it is very film noir. I agree.
And if you look at the credits for the director here, he seems to have been coming from a cinematography background, and I think that might have been one of the reasons why he concentrates so much on the look and the atmosphere of the film. And I got to believe that's helped you and the other actors in finding your place and role in this film.
Well, it seems interesting, that concept. I found where we were shooting in New York in the dead of winter, subway stop Jamaica.
Right.
And the set size was so small, it added to the compression.
Right.
Of the story. I mean, one of my favorite writers of all time is Sam Shepard, and one of my favorite plays of all time is True West.
Mm-hmm.
And that story, I would love to say we were in the likes of that, but a Pulitzer Prize winner and fantastic script. I could only hope that we would scratch that surface. But it was along that same character intention where there's two main characters with a common interest.
Right.
That then moves into dramatic conflict.
Exactly.
And, you know, and then that set, having that feeling of pressure and conflict adds to the story getting more and more like a pressure cooker until the lid finally blows.
Right.
So I agree with you. Cinematically, I think you needed to kind of go into that territory and kind of, you know, have the space slowly get smaller and smaller and smaller until something blows.
Absolutely. And it also gives it almost a stage type of feel. I could see this working on a stage. I mean, you could do this on a stage because the peripheral stuff isn't important.
Yeah, that it's actually very astute, because when I came into this project, when you're on a smaller budget independent film that you're doing for the love of the art, there's not a lot of time to waste. So you're on a 6-day, 12-hour shoot schedule in the snow. And since I was 76 pages of this 93-page script, boy, I better come off book. There's no time to learn lines. So I like a play, and I've done plays. I came off book. I mean, just ready to go. Wherever we start, I knew this script forwards, backwards, sideways, up, down, this way, that way. Wherever we were going to go, if he said page 14, I said, what line are we starting at page 14? I'm ready to go. It really took that kind of complete commitment to be able to make something like this go when you're just dealing with a couple actors.
Sure.
And that's it. You know, there's no time to say, hey, let's switch up to our other scenes. Why don't you actors go, you know, get it together and come on back. it's all you, baby.
Yeah, and exactly. And because of the intimate and the closeness of this film, you and the other actor have to just really get your chemistry down pretty heavily, because it all hangs on your shoulders, doesn't it? The interaction between the two of you, and that's the movie.
Absolutely true. And now it's very interesting when they talk about chemistry. that chemistry isn't necessarily people liking each other or people disliking each other.
Oh, yeah, not at all.
Just as certain as the my mother's French, so je ne sais quoi.
Yes.
You know, it's the French say je ne sais quoi, which means I don't know what.
Right.
It's, we don't know why oil and vinegar mixed tastes so well together. However, no matter how hard you shake it, it always separates. So they're their own thing. But somehow, you know, it's an unbeatable combination when the chemistry is sort of right. So you kind of hope, and I don't know if you see that chemistry really until the editing or until the cameras start rolling. But when it's there, it's great. And when it's not there, it's clearly evident, unfortunately.
So what did you guys do? Did you do anything in particular to kind of to develop that, or did it just fall naturally?
It's a very good question. You know, there's been projects where I just felt that we had chemistry, and when I saw it back on film, it was void of that chemistry that I thought was so clear.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's projects where I thought I just had no connection with this person whatsoever, but I'm a professional, they're a professional, you know, we have to get our game on. And then you see something that just is, as they say again, you know, that I don't know what, somehow there's some sort of electric connection or fiber of different emotional elements that somehow comes searing through. So I don't know if it's something you could prepare for. If it is, boy, would I like to read that book.
Well, did you spend much time together before filming?
At the time that we had, we spent our time trying to get over roadblocks and detours that were in our way, whether that happened to be weather or story, you know, just basic, you know, restrictions. If you're going to go whitewater rafting, they're going to be, you know, down there by turn 7. Boy, it gets nasty, so you guys better be prepared. So in that kind of way, we didn't spend time like you would with a play, getting plenty of rehearsal and going through things. You know, you needed to come to the fight with your gloves on, ready to mix it.
Well, and the relationship, you talk about chemistry doesn't necessarily mean liking each other. Here, the chemistry has a lot of subtle changes. I mean, there's a time when you're kind of both dancing around each other, almost like spider and fly type thing. You know, there's even a codependence period where you kind of start depending each other, that, you know, you're trying to outwit each other. So I think that the relationship changes subtly throughout the film. I don't think there is a steady relationship between these characters. Is that how you see it?
Well, that's what I intended, so I'm glad you see that. I think it was more my responsibility being the character I'm playing that has that internal conflict and developing that conflict with the rest of the, you know, I have my world conflict,
right.
You know, my own private Idaho that I'm dealing with, and then, you know, my conflict with the world, so to speak, and then this other element, this person that comes in. I felt that there was plenty of opportunity to meander and work within that area.
Mm-hmm.
His intention is a little bit more single and directed in the way of...
He's more deliberate.
His intention is pretty clear. My intention is the one that has to, you know, listen, prey and predator. You know, I'm clearly the predator.
Mm-hmm.
And he's clearly the prey of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
So the predator has to stalk his prey in an interesting way, because if it's too quick to kill, it's kind of boring.
Now, and the film's, of course, about this this screenplay that's supposed to be the greatest thing any of these characters have ever seen in their lives. And I have to ask you, with something so subjective, something so abstract, because we never really see much of it, it doesn't get to play a huge part physically in the film. How was it?
Thank God for that.
Yeah.
That's exactly the question you're asking. If you did, imagine having to live up to that.
Exactly.
Imagine if we're describing the most sexy, beautiful woman that has ever... I mean, made Bridget Bardot look like a dog.
Yeah.
Imagine now all of a sudden we have to show that woman. What are you going to do? You're stuck. So
exactly.
That's where you get a little bit of writer's and artistic license. As long as we never show it, or never...
Exactly.
Win it, we are not, bound and gagged to have to deliver it.
And you're doomed to disappoint.
It is objective, and it is ethereal in that sense of the pie in the sky script.
And you're doomed to disappoint. If you attempt to show it, you can't not disappoint.
Absolutely.
There's just no way around it.
If we had to show it, we would never have, the sizzle and the steak. You know, as long as we don't have to show the steak, we can say, oh, my God, you know, listen to that sizzle. Oh, it's so juicy. It's unbelievable. Can you smell it? Can you smell it? But if you have to show and taste the steak, you've killed yourself.
But that's got to be harder.
How many times when I hear a movie, it's just unbelievable.
Sure.
Best movie people have ever seen, and my expectations are so high.
Right.
I feel, oh, wow, let down. You know, for this, in this particular case, for me, it's a dream come true. I've got the Independent Spirit Award and two Best Acting Awards.
Yes.
As Best Actor in this, so three kind of in a row, and a Grand Jury Prize. I feel like my friends that want to come see the film, I'll say, hey, listen, it's not that good. You know, I'm kind of apologizing for the film. Because I just feel I know myself when somebody tells me it's the best thing ever, and then I say, yeah, it was good, but was it?
But I think here's where you deserve the awards, and here's where I think it's got to be more difficult, is that because you're trying to sell something that you can't show in any shape or form. To me, it's got to be akin to, acting against a green screen monster or something, but even worse, because here you're trying to sell this concept and trying to get the audience to just get us to believe that this script can be so good. These people are willing to go to all these lengths to control it, to possess it, and that's where the awards have to come in, because that's got to be a lot harder than just dealing with something that you can show someone.
Yeah, I think so. I think, a little bit of the teaser is that the audience, may feel, because the audience is always a step ahead.
Right.
You know, the audience is much smarter than the people telling the story, and that's the trap that you have when you're telling the story.
Mm-hmm.
You have to realize that they're always presuming what's going to happen while something else is happening.
Yeah.
So, in this case, I think the audience feels like they're going to see this story. You know, they're going to see this movie or get to hear this script, and they don't. So, that was intentional.
Sure.
But by the other hand, like you said, you have to sell it.
Exactly.
You have to sell it really big. You're selling something that you never even see.
Exactly.
So that takes, a good performance, hopefully, to be able to get people excited about something that they never see.
Sure. And I'm encouraged by something you said, and that is saying that the audience is smart. My biggest problems I have when I see a film, and I get to watch a lot as a reviewer, and I hate films where the filmmaker obviously thinks I'm an idiot and thinks he has to hit me over the head with everything and make sure I got it 20 times. And it's refreshing to see a filmmaker, an actor, that's out there saying, you know what, our audience can get this. We can go subtle. We can go small. We can do this and trust that they're gonna pick up what we're laying down.
You know, I so agree with you. Why does anybody want to try to create something for idiots? I mean, the idea is that art is supposed to provoke thought and emotion and life spirit. So and I've heard this on sets too, where people go, well, the audience, come on, they don't know better. And I said, is that your game audience? You know, somebody that doesn't know better. I said, what audience do you have? any audience knows better. You know, they've seen more than one movie. They understand that the movie is trying to take them to the right and then swing left. So they're presumptive in that direction. Let's not underestimate the audience, because that is who we're communicating to. You know, when you see these great directors too, Hitchcock and Scorsese, et cetera, it's like they completely catch you off guard.
Yes.
That emotion in itself for an audience to know where it's going,
right,
and then be surprised and caught off guard. It's like, it's so refreshing, and it's so exciting. It makes you feel happy, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to in life, when you open a letter and then you're shocked. You're in a movie and it's a transportation device. You're vicariously living through other characters.
Mm-hmm.
So there are dramas and foils and happiness and failures. It's a two-hour ride.
Right.
Know? But you want to identify. So.
And people who love film, that's really what they're there for. If you love film, that's what you're coming to do.
Yeah. It's
exactly what you're coming to do. Now, I picked up on something, and you can tell me if I'm right or wrong in this. I kind of got this idea by the time the film came to an end, and we don't want to give anything away to the audience, but I kind of got an idea by the time we got to the end that the movie I saw, that the play that acted out in front of me was in some way the script. I got the impression that these guys were living what the script was. Is there anything to that, or am I just seeing things that aren't there?
You know what? I think that that measures your intelligence, because I think it's imagination. It's supposed to provoke imagination.
Yeah.
I haven't heard that, but
okay.
If I was giving this like a storyline as we're writing what it is, I would put that in.
Yeah.
I think that's a measure to your intelligence that this thing is art imitating life or life imitating art, and is this a parallel universe between the actual characters that are meandering through something that these potential art life characters are going through. I mean, I think that's really cool. I don't think that was the intention, although mm-hmm. I'm not the writer.
Sure.
So it could be. You know, writers like to keep little secrets too. and good writers don't want to reveal all the secrets so that the actors don't telegraph the story. But I like your version.
Okay. So tell me what gravitated you towards this role. How did you find out about it, and what made you decide you wanted to do it?
Well, it's interesting. I haven't ever shared this, but I will share this with you now. My mother's Parisian, you know. My mm-hmm. father was Italian.
Yeah.
And I'm an only child. I have that French side, and I had that Italian side being a child. I started as a street performer up in the Bay Area, San Francisco, eating fire, blowing fire, juggling, chain escapes, all these things. I had this one-man show, and you'd call that an act,
right?
You know, which is oddly later that you become an actor, or acting would just be an extension of that.
Sure.
Then I was writing my show, and by the time I was 14, I was living in Pigalle, performing in the Moulin Rouge by myself.
Wow.
It was just such a life experience to see so many different people. I mean, we all saw the movie The Moulin Rouge.
Uh-huh.
And I was really there at 14 years old by myself in Paris. and it was just, overwhelming and amazing.
Yeah.
So I went on, performing all over the world. And my mom, being Parisian, the Europeans were much more free about letting their children go to different countries and see different things, which I was very happy and fortunate. I never had any negative circumstance or bad luck that way. And then as I got older and I migrated down to Los Angeles, it seemed like I was the guy that performed in Whiskey of Go-Go and Roxy and eventually the Greek Theater. And I thought, where can you take juggling to? juggling, for God's sake.
Okay.
How interesting is juggling? So I originated this thing of the guy that, and everybody's heard of this guy, although they don't associate it with me, the guy that juggles three running chainsaws.
Yes, I've seen it. Yeah.
I kind of took juggling to this, world-class stunt level, and it was really neat, and I performed all over the place, and the show was predominantly one-man comedy with stunts and really fun to do, and people started to approach me about being an actor.
Yeah.
And the issue that was in everybody's way is that he's really funny, so we don't really see him being able to do anything dramatic.
Right.
And at that point, I changed my name. People knew me. I went by James Marcel. I changed my name to James Wilder, and I decided to reinvent myself as a very dramatic actor. And so I started to get some very dramatic roles, and then this one particular role that I became known for, not in a wide scope area, but certainly in the Hollywood area, was a Miramax movie where I played the life story of a serial killer that they flew me to Winsville State Penitentiary to meet this guy on death row.
Uh-huh.
And I did this, I did a really good job, if I do so myself, with that story. So now everybody just knew me. Really intense guy. People were almost afraid to talk to me, and I followed it up by playing a crack athlete that overdoses on crack cocaine. So now it was, anything but funny. I mean, anything but even just like, I would not even get a role that was, I was somewhere between Eric Roberts and Christopher Walken, and Dennis Hopper.
Okay.
These were the roles that I would get, which are really colorful, great roles, but I lost my father. He passed away on Christmas Eve some years ago, probably about 8-9 years ago now. And quite shocking. And at that point, when I lost him, and my mom was very, obviously, just destroyed by it, I came to this sort of realization that I thought, wow, how much of these things that I was doing to seek the approval of my father.
Right.
Not that he was a hard guy at all, but it's just a little bit of that Italian or that father-son pecking order that, do something with your life, make something with your life. And I felt like, wow, I did a Broadway show, and it was a hit, and I did a television show, and we won Emmy for best, one-hour drama at nighttime.
Right.
I said, I did this, Miramax movie, which got glowing reviews and all this kind of stuff, and I felt like, geez, I feel like I'm kind of satisfied, what was the acceptance of him, and I can just, I don't know, I didn't have anybody to do it for. In an odd way, I was kind of, he was my corner man. I wanted to make him proud, and felt like, there's nobody around to kind of, I don't know, in an odd way, impress or do it for or to share the excitement with.
Right.
It just basically retired, and I'd done quite well for myself, so I just started to go into architecture and do these, lifestyle spaces and whatnot. And then, oddly enough, 7-8 years transpired, and I'm in a lounge bar called Hemingway's, named after the great writer.
Sure.
Ernest Hemingway, obviously.
Yeah.
And somebody taps me on the shoulder, and I turn around, and he looks like a writer. There's all these books, because the motif of Hemingway's is all, literature. And I said, hello? He said, yes. He goes, I'm a writer. I said, imagine that. And he said, I wanted to give you a script to read. And I said, okay. So what's it about? He goes, it's the story of a writer. I said, so, you're giving me the story of a writer, and you're a writer, and we're in a bar named after a writer. I said, is Ashton Kutcher going to pop out right now? I'm going to get up and punk.
Right.
And, he looked at me in a quizzical way, and it was the truth. And I thought, I have to read this. It was sort of like the trifecta at a horse track. Really? So I read the script. I thought, this is really, really challenging. I said, the beauty is you haven't worked by choice, even though nobody would believe that. I said, for 7-8 years, I said, if you fall on your face, it'll just be, he chose something that was, he chose to bite something off bigger than he could chew. I said, and if you nail it, what a great way to come back. And
that's
so
true.
I guess I nailed it because, so many great things have come through. Of course, I get a little emotional. I think, God, it would have been so nice to share with my dad. But, not a perfect one, but it was a great, great way to come back into these things. And that story, by the way, I it's almost like self-realization. I didn't even really know this until I kind of revealed that to myself.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Didn't know why I stopped, really, and some of these things just kind of came about later,
sure.
It's interesting.
Well, it sounds like the movie was very cathartic for you. Yeah, sounds like the movie was very cathartic for you. It was very therapeutic for you.
I think so. I very much think so, yeah.
So what's next for you? What, we have anything else coming out?
Well, it's a very good question. You're always in trouble when you decide to do a story based somehow around Hollywood.
Yeah.
Because the movie-going audience sees Hollywood in one way, and Hollywood completely different way. It's like when you get a travel brochure to go to Venice Beach, California, it looks fantastic. Then you get there and you just say, let's get in the car and let's lock ourselves in here. It's scary.
Right.
So it's the same thing with a Hollywood story in the way that it's very hard to communicate it well because the larger demographic, which is the audience, is looking at it saying, that's not the Hollywood we know.
Right.
And then if you communicate the glamour of Hollywood, Hollywood itself says, if you're going to poke fun at it, at least represent us correctly.
Yes.
So this movie kind of slipped the punch. It kind of got in there. We haven't had any, negative, another bad Hollywood story told.
Yeah.
So that was really then, oddly enough, the next thing that seems like it's really piqued my interest is a completely different angle, but another Hollywood-type story with this virtual reality element that came into it. So that's the thing I'm most interested in. It looks like this thing may go. So,
all right.
I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, yeah, we'll keep it out for you, and you know, hopefully see you in something again real soon, because I enjoyed the performance. I really did. I thought the performance made the film, quite honestly. I think that although there's a lot of, like we talked about, a lot of neat subtle things in the film, I think that if the performance hadn't done the things that it did, I think this movie could have fallen a lot flatter, and I think that you really gave life to the film, and I appreciate you taking the time to share your experience with us.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you very much. It means a lot to me.